And was this occurring just within our solar system, or were you taken outside of our solar system to conduct these kinds of diplomatic smoothing over missions, if you like?
The vast majority that I recall are all within our solar system, and mostly at Saturn, which is where I stayed most of the time. I did leave the solar system. I don't have a lot of memory. I just remember having left and spending time elsewhere, because I know we have, that I was aware of at that time, we had, even then, throughout that 60 years I was in the program, they ended up with about 120 different planets that humans had a presence on, Earth humans had a presence on.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome Chris O'Connor to Exopolitics Today. Chris has worked in the entertainment industry, worked with a number of A-list celebrities from Hollywood. He has memories of being very young when he was recruited into the secret space programs and went through a really amazing process that he's going to tell us about. And he's also developed some really amazing therapeutic electrical healing technologies, which we'll also get to talk about. So welcome, Chris, to Exopolitics Today.
Hi, it's such a pleasure to be here, Michael. I really appreciate the invitation and the time.
Yes, well, I'm kind of slightly envious now that you're living in in Hawaii. I won't say what part of Hawaii, but I missed the surfing there, but I got Aloha shirt, so that's my compensation.
It's all good. I love it.
Okay, so you told me a little bit about your work in Hollywood, and it's always good to give listeners an idea of your professional background and, you know, what it is that you did and what it was that kind of like marked you out as having some unique skill sets that become very pertinent when we're talking about the secret space program. So how did you end up working with some A-list celebrity actors?
Well, I started off actually in casting, running cameras for casting sessions, you know, for auditions. And it just kind of worked up from there. I started doing my own auditions and then also presenting to producers and directors and actors, you know, show them, you know, you go on a location, for example, and you have auditions for local actors that you use for the film. And then in that process, you're exposed to the producers, directors, and actors. And so through that process, I met some A-list celebrities that liked my work and that I got along very well with, because I treated them just like a human being, you know, and it just kind of went from there. And I ended up being assistant to a couple of A-list celebrities for a short time and worked with them. And then I moved into photography and did celebrity at-home photography for publications. So it's just kind of, I've kind of morphed into it. I was also, you know, art director and production designer. So I've always had that kind of art bent to my work.
Right. And at some point you started to explore these memories that you had as a very young person. I mean, going as far back as 2 years old. And I think you mentioned in our pre-interview that it was around 10 to 12 years ago that some of the dreams that you recall having going as far back as when you were two, that these were actually memories rather than dreams. So can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, in 1970, when I was 2 years old, I was taken. And I can't say for sure if it was the Air Force or if it was the Navy, you know, but this was an agreement that I had made prior to being incarnate, that I wanted to work with the SSP program. Soul family, my soul group had kind of a bigger plan for me to work with a lot of different races through the, you know, Earth's SSP, what we will call colloquially call it SSP now, but through these programs. So they took me at two, and I was age advanced through a pretty horrific series of procedures over the next few weeks until I was about, 25-ish, in my mid-20s. And so then through this other technology they have, they were able to retrieve and unlock my memories and my agreement to do that. And so all those memories came back at that time, and I kind of knew what to do and started from there.
So this is something that is very difficult for a lot of people to understand. And certainly it was a stumbling block for me when I heard it. I mean, I've heard about age regression technology, and that's something that many have spoken about. And there's people that have actually said that they were involved in the development of that kind of technology. But age progression, it was something that was fairly new to me. I had really not understood how that would work. But it was when I heard a couple of the interviewees that I've worked with recently, Jean-Charles Moyen and also Andrew Bashiago, who both say that they went through age progression processes as youngsters, that it made me reconsider that, what you described was something very, very possible. So, before we actually describe, or you describe exactly how that technology age progression works, tell us a little bit about this kind of soul agreement, this pre-life agreement that you had made. Because, why would the Navy or the Air Force identify you 2 years old as someone so significant for them that they have to age progress you so that you begin working with them in 1970? Why couldn't they just wait, 14 years, 16 years, till you were like a teenager and then bring you into the program?
That's an excellent question. I don't fully know the answer as to why they would do that, but I think it's because they can and it's easy for them to do. And they don't have to wait in that instance. And I don't recall if there was a specific reason, if there was some sort of timing thing with another race to work with, or I had to get through training to do certain things and then, to match a deadline. I'm not sure why they would do that, but I do know it's just kind of the norm in a lot of ways for them. And so maybe it's just easier to unlock memories, newly age progressed without, being without having preset memories. I'm just not 100% sure on that.
Okay, so somehow they had pre-identified you or your soul as someone with the skill set that they needed. So was that soul that was in that two-year-old body, you, was that the soul of an extraterrestrial or someone else? I mean, why was it that they said, okay, we need Chris, because the soul inhabiting that two-year-old body has skills that we need? So was that from another space program? Was it extraterrestrial?
Yes, my soul group is not Earth-based. We're very, very old. So I think that because I've been around on Earth for a long time, my group, and we've been coming and assisting for a long time, I think it was just kind of a natural transition and natural choice.
Well, I know Jean-Charles Moyen described something similar, that because of his prior lives as an extraterrestrial, that he was age progressed at four because there was a need for him. And then they reversed him back to to 4 years old. And that was around the same time as well as you. Now, what makes this plausible, and I can't pretend to say I understand the principles behind age progression or age regression, is that I know William Tompkins, who I worked with for several years. He was working for this company, TRW, that from 1967 to 1971, it developed age regression technology. So it would not surprise me that they were similarly working with age progression. And that kind of fits in with your timetable too, that you said you underwent this in 1970. So that's right around the time Bill Tompkins said TRW was working on this age regression technology. So I don't know if you know anything about that.
That's the first I've heard of it. Yeah, it's interesting.
Okay. All right. So, you know, there is a basis for understanding how age progression and age regression can be developed and used. So in your case, how was it actually put in process? I mean, how were you as a two-year-old age progressed to a 25-year-old body? I mean, what happened?
Well, it's kind of a horrific scenario, but I will explain. It's basically, I was taken and placed into like an acrylic tube is the best thing I can, you know, describe it as. And within that tube was this like this purplish pinkish gel. And from what I recall now, that gel is like a bio gel, which is made up of some material retrieved from another race, off planet race, from quite a distance away. And it's an extremely expensive gel. But what they can do is they can replicate that gel, you know, allow it to grow sort of like laboratory, you know, they can grow it and they can extract your DNA and place within the gel. So it's like I guess the easiest way to describe it would be a gel made up of like T cells. And then they add your DNA to that. And then you can advance growth in this way. You're basically drowned in it. You know, I remember the process of being drowned within this gel. And then they injected like large needles within my body into some of my bones and into my internal organs so that gel could be injected so that basically I grow evenly both outside and inside. And then that lasted for a few weeks, is the best I can remember, until they would transfer me once into a larger tank after a few days. I did see a movie a while back. I think it was called Wolverine Origins or something, where they did something really, really similar. And I was kind of shocked to see it, but it was a very, very interesting and similar process to that in that film.
Right. Okay. So this purple gel, you don't know what it was. I mean, could it have, it was an extraterrestrial compound. Was it, did it have kind of nanotechnology in it, anything like that? What do you know of it?
The most I know of it is that it's organically based with a technology base combined. So it would have to be nano because it's gelatinous, right? It's like a thick water. And then when your DNA is added to it, it grows within that as well. And so it's like, so that gel, they can keep it. And then it's always locked into your, you know, DNA. So it's a really expensive process for them. And they can grow clones in other tanks that isn't quite the same process that costs a lot less. But with certain people, for some reason, rather than extracting your consciousness and memories out of a two-year-old and putting it into a 25-year-old clone they've created, it's more stable if they grow the body and the memory and consciousness remain intact throughout that process. There's always a possibility of losing the consciousness and the memories when they're extracted. So, you know, they did that with some people, but not with everyone.
Well, I know Tony Rodriguez, who's also going to be part of the Galactic Spiritual Informers Conference, you know, from October 21st to 23rd. Tony's going to be there. And he described how his consciousness was taken when he was 10 years old. He was brought into the programs and his gray extraterrestrials took his consciousness out and transferred it into a cloned body. And then that's how he went and did his 20 and back. Now, in your case, as you described, they didn't transfer your consciousness into a clone body, they decided that they would actually age progress you to 25 because, as you say, this is a more stable foundation to retain the consciousness and the memories that they needed, because you had skills or memories that they needed. And if they transferred your consciousness, maybe some of those memories could have been lost, or even the consciousness could have been impaired in some way.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. So your DNA, your consciousness, memories are all transposed from a two-year-old body into a 25-year-old body. So now, I mean, how would that work? I mean, you as a two-year-old, I mean, you're, you know, you're just developing rudimentary language.
Yeah.
So does the consciousness of a prior life take over? I mean, is that what happens?
Yes, because all of that's within your DNA. And once they unlock that, all of that comes back. You know, all of the memories, your consciousness of who you are, your reason for being there, whatever, everything you've ever experienced your whole entire life up to that point comes right back.
I see. So as a two-year-old, Chris O'Connor obviously didn't have many memories of much at all. So the memories of the prior life and, you know, that extraterrestrial life just essentially took over that 25-year-old body and was now working for the Air Force or the Navy. So that would actually make sense. Why the Navy or why the Air Force would say, okay, we want to get this little, you know, we want to get the consciousness inside this two-year-old human baby because we know it's an extraterrestrial soul that's incarnated, and we need that person with all his skills and the memories and actually age progression. Actually, that makes sense now, or why they would do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So now in terms of your memories in the Secret Space Program, you've described having served in several 20 and backs. So now with the very first 20 and back, where did you go? I mean, your age progressed, you're now in a 25-year-old body, you've got the consciousness of an ET, the Air Force or the Navy says, you know, sign here and we're going to send you over there. So what do you recall about signing, and what do you recall about being sent off to serve in a program?
Interestingly, I don't recall signing anything the first 20 years because my contract was basically signed before I incarnated. So that just carried over. I did sign it twice after that, and that I do have some memories of. But for the first 20 years, basically what I was meant to do was be a liaison or like an ambassadorial type of position when negotiating with other races. And so the reason for me to do that was because most of the time these other races knew that I wasn't human based, but I was working with and through them. So there was a greater trust factor. And also because I worked on a telepathic level, whether that was, you know, a direct telepathic conversation, or if it was just through emotion or visuals that would be sent, or that I could connect and, you know, speak to somebody on. And I would sit in meetings with these races because they were always negotiating contracts, working with other races on other planets. Sometimes we'd have to go and repair damage done by one faction of human-based SSP programs that would do damage on some planet. We would have to go. At this time, I was actually with the United Nations, escorted by the Navy and Air Force different times. And then we would go and have to send our apologies and work out a deal to, you know, make things right. That was my basic skill set, because there's a trust level that most of these races had with me because they knew, you know, who I really was.
So just to kind of clarify a little bit, because the Navy Secret Space Program and the Air Force Secret Space Program, as far as I've found through my research, you know, these are very distinct programs. The Navy is the older and the more advanced program, and they're more focused on deep space operations or even interstellar operations, whereas the Air Force is more focused on the kind of like the cislunar environment, just the Earth, the Moon, and that kind of area, kind of like a planetary coast guard, if you like.
Yeah, and often throughout our immediate solar system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So can you tell me or tell us more about this United Nations space program that was working with the Navy and the Air Force? So are we talking about a separate space program altogether, or are we just talking about a unit that was working inside of the Navy's space program?
The best I recall is it was a separate program that was representing Earth as a whole, all of humanity, whereas the Naval and Air Force programs were more United States. But they were, the United States is in forefront, but they didn't represent the entire planet.
Okay, so this United Nations space program that had its own ships, its own kind of system of crews, setting up crews and servicemen or servicewomen and manning these ships. So what do you recall about serving on one of these Navy space program craft? I mean, anything distinctive for you? And do you remember when it began?
Well, the best I can recall is I was very, very segmented. You know, they would put me in small rooms. That's where I would stay most of the time. I was away from other people, mostly because of infringement of, since I was doing this telepathic type of work, I would be separated. And I was mostly with the United Nations that was subcontracted, you know, that their travel was subcontracted between both the Air Force and the Navy. So what at that time, at least, they didn't really have their own transportation, the United Nations, as much. They'd use what was already in place, which was the United States ships, at least in my experience. And most of those ships looked just like if you're on a battleship. I mean, they weren't comfortable. They weren't lovely. They were tiny, small rooms that were just really light mint color. But it's interesting because there was one technology that I remember was I never saw lights anywhere. It was always something, somehow it was always this weird kind of super light green light coming from somewhere. But, you know, all of my interaction was highly controlled, you know, and compartmentalized. So I don't have a lot of memory. I just remember, you know, a few trips in some of these ships. I have memories of other ships that were not human, but not so much the human ships.
Yes, well, I know there have been some that describe a kind of like a United Nations space program that began at the end of the Cold War, and that the end of the Cold War was brought about because there had been this agreement between major nations to collaborate. So that would have put that around, say, 1990. Now, does that kind of fit in with your, I mean, you began serving in 1970, but you served three terms, or you signed up twice after that. So how does that kind of time frame fit in with what you recall?
It fits in perfectly, as best I can recall, because after that, around the 1990 mark is, of course, my second term. And that's when I started going mostly to the Saturn station, you know, which was not a human station. It was another whole different thing.
Yes. Yeah, so tell us, what was the Saturn station?
Well, the Saturn station is, there are a number of coalitions that exist throughout our galaxy and actually throughout the universe. These are coalitions of races that have already advanced beyond where we are as humans now. And once they advance to a certain level, it's kind of a unwritten rule that you assist lower races that are in that process of evolution. And to do so, you come together with the coalition and you make some, you know, basic unwritten rules of, you know, what to do and what not to do. And then you have stations throughout solar systems that these races that are evolving are where they're located. And there's two or three at least here in our own solar system, Neptune, Jupiter, Saturn. And I was mostly in Saturn, and Saturn was just a massive round ship, just looked metallic. It was, it looked much like if people are aware of the Death Star on Star Wars, it looked similar to that. But it was massive, miles across, you know, I guess the size of that would be in the Star Wars shows. And then that's where all of these other races would, they would all have their own bases within this large station. And that station is just out of phase. Here, we can't see it with our human eyes, but it's there, it's within the rings of Saturn. And it's a pretty amazing thing to see.
That's interesting. So Saturn, Jupiter, and Neptune are the locations where there are major interstellar or kind of like different extraterrestrial groups will meet and convene, and there's meeting places and diplomatic negotiations go on. So the Saturn base is where you spent quite a bit of time.
Okay. Yeah, I'm aware of the other two, and there are others, but some of the others have a larger grouping of what we would consider a negative, you know, race. They have their own agenda. And there are some other locations throughout our solar system with them as well. But those are the three I'm familiar with. And the one I was on primarily was Saturn.
Now, you had some extraterrestrial friends. You mentioned one, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Digtem was a...
Oh, yeah, it's Jigadim.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah. Tough word.
Yeah, so tell us about him.
Yeah, he is, the best that I can recall, he was Andromedan, and he was a very, very good friend of mine throughout the SSP, where we were very close. He was a light blue color, and he had a very large head and really tiny eyes. And these eyes, if you looked into this race's eyes, it was as if you were looking at a galaxy all of its own. You know, they actually weren't static. They were dynamic, and they would move based on their emotions. And I was just very close, and he still visits from time to time, actually, still comes to me. So just says hi, basically.
Well, I know you mentioned Arcturians as well, that you were close with Arcturians. So yeah, that raises the question. Why don't you tell us about the Arcturians as well? What kind of experiences did you have with the Arcturians?
With them, they're very, very close to the Andromedans as well, because they're from the same system, essentially. Historically. So they're also blue. They're much thinner and taller, not much taller than the Andromedans, but they're, you know, very thin, have a different shape head. You know, it's larger, but it kind of comes up to, goes around, like I have a big brain sort of thing. They're also blue. And there's another race I worked with quite a bit, and I can't say with definition that they are also Arcturian, but I worked with them a lot, and they were also blue, but they were the color of, you know, that cartoon from years ago, they were Smurfs, the little Smurf characters. They had that kind of a coloration, but they had iridescent skin, and they were all clones of one another, or had been for many years, and they're all extremely similar, and they just pure white hair. And I worked with them quite a bit because I was able to communicate with them very easily. And they specifically allowed some of my memories to come through. They actually, because they believe that people should really know what's going on here on Earth. So they assisted me in some of my memory retrieval and understanding what those things are that I'm recalling.
So in terms of your past life or past lives, you were with, was your soul incarnated with the Andromedans, the Arcturians, or this other third race, the kind of blue-skinned race?
I've definitely incarnated through the Andromedans, probably through the Arcturians as well. And there's another race historically from Venus many millions of years ago, the Ra Collective. I've incarnated through them as well. I have memories even being on Earth with them. So I know there's more. I don't have the memories with many of the others that I do with those particular races.
Okay. All right. Well, that's very significant. You being specifically chosen by the Navy, by this UN program to help them conduct negotiations with extraterrestrials, because if that was your soul heritage, then you would have brought to the table, to the Earth table, a lot of knowledge and a lot of information that could help them come up with diplomatic agreements. So, I mean, people think that the whole extraterrestrial issue is something that's covered up, which it is, but sometimes they have a lot of difficulty getting beyond the whole question of like, you know, prove that there's a cover-up, and you know, where's the evidence, where's the photographs, and so, which mm-hmm. is all relevant. Mm-hmm. But the thing that's always worth reminding ourselves is that, and this is how I got really drawn into it, was that diplomatic meetings are happening between Earth representatives and extraterrestrials, even though the rest of the public is struggling over the proof and the evidence and photographs and all of that, that the governments keep us kind of like in the dark, squabbling over whether or not there's evidence that ETs even exist, but yet they're holding diplomatic missions and reaching agreements. So do you remember anything about agreements that were reached?
I do. I, of course, can't share any details that I recall, but I can do broad sweeping things. For example, some of the darker factions of the Earth-based SSP programs wouldn't be as kind in negotiations. If there were crystals on some planet they wanted, or there were resources on some planet they wanted, and they weren't easily given, they'd take it anyway. And then, of course, we would have to come along, meet with that race, send our apologies, you know, try to explain that, you know, not that doesn't represent the whole planet, that just represents this faction, you know, and come to an agreement and an understanding, you know, and that wasn't always easy. So we spent, unfortunately, a lot of time just repairing damage done.
So this dark faction, I mean, are we talking about a corporate space program? Are we talking about the German program out of Antarctica, the so-called Dark Fleet, that they go out there, mm-hmm. they do all of this dark stuff, create a lot of friction and enmity, and you, the Navy would come in, or this UN program would come in with negotiators like you, and you're going to try and smooth things over. Is that pretty much the way it worked?
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty much exactly how it worked, unfortunately.
And was this occurring just within our solar system, or were you taken outside of our solar system to conduct these kinds of diplomatic smoothing over missions, if you like?
Yeah. The vast majority that I recall are all within our solar system, and mostly at Saturn, which is where I stayed most of the time. But I did leave the solar system. I don't have a lot of memory. I just remember having left and spending time elsewhere, because I know we have, I mean, that I was aware of at that time, we had, even then, throughout that 60 years I was in the program, they ended up with about 120 different planets that humans had a presence on, Earth humans had a presence on.
Okay, so that confirms that a lot of our human activities were happening outside of our solar system. So do you remember anything in particular about this dark faction? Were you given briefings about them? Like were they like former Nazis that were now part of a dark fleet working with reptilians, that anything you were briefed about?
I was never officially briefed about anything along that line, but I knew about it because we all talked about things. And that we knew who was doing it was a lot of these other bases that Earth humans have. They actually believe the Earth has been destroyed, you know, and that they're the only humans left. But then they're on 120 different planets, and a lot of them think that they're the only ones left. And that's because it's some of these dark fleets want to keep them controlled and fighting all the bad guys that are out there, when really it's kind of them that's causing the problem. And so it's just, you know, and I knew that it was some of the German factions that left Earth, and then they were just, they picked up other humans, made other contracts. A lot of people that have gone missing throughout the years were actually picked up by these programs because they had some sort of skill set that they wanted, and they just kidnapped them and take them.
Okay. Yeah, we've heard that that a lot of these humans were kidnapped or kind of under false pretenses taken to places like Mars where they became slave labor. But now you're telling us that a lot of these people were actually taken to these off-world colonies in other solar systems, 120 of them. And yeah, that, well, I first heard this from Alex Collier, who is also going to be speaking at this October conference in Orlando. Alex, I remember, talked about these off-world colonies back in the late 1990s, that he was given information from the Andromedans about them. And I remember at the time, it was amazing information, but you know, no one else was talking about that, these other human colonies in other solar systems, and how humans were really doing a lot of bad stuff out there. But Alex was talking about that back in the 90s.
Yeah, I've heard of that, and I'm actually looking forward to meeting him. But I don't listen to a lot of other people's stories because I want to keep what I remember as pure, and I don't want to cross too much stuff, you know. So I'm not aware of most of these folks that are out there.
Well, that's actually good. I'm glad you do that, because it's really people like me that should be doing that. That, you know, we should be the ones keeping track and doing the cross-referencing, and because that all helps corroborate people's testimonies. And that way you keep your testimony pure. So I am glad that you do that. So during your service as a diplomat for this United Nations space program, and you're spending a lot of time at Saturn, you come across some very interesting types of beings. And one of the beings that you describe are crystalline beings. Can you describe, what are these crystalline beings?
They're really fascinating. They're not quite in your presence physically, but they have a presence of light. And that light has, it looks visually as if it's made of crystals, because, you know, as if when you move like a diamond, how it sparkles and it's different facets, that's sort of the look that they have. They're kind of a pinkish color, and they can form into, because they're very, very high. They've been around for literally billions of years. They're from very close to the center of our galaxy. And they can just keep a basic humanoid form so that we can relate to seeing them, but they don't need to do that. They're just, you know, they've evolved beyond anything physical, really, you know, and they kind of create a face, so you have something to look at, you know. And so they're stunning, and the feeling of their presence, you know, it's just indescribable. You know, we think we know what love feels like here on Earth, you know, but we have no idea. We've been so shut down emotionally that when we're in the presence of some of these races, it's just indescribable, the depth of love and acceptance.
Fascinating. Well, I know you have described one meeting you had near Saturn, one of the at the space station there, with a group of extraterrestrials who had been harmed or injured in some way by the Dark Fleet, by the negative human space program, and one of them got so angry that he shot you. So you want to tell us what happened?
Oh yeah, that was traumatic. It was right after I signed my first. So I was first contract after about 20 years. I think probably within the first year. So say within my 21st year of actually being in the program, I was on Saturn. One faction of the SSP had killed, you know, as I recall, hundreds of thousands of these entities on their own planet, because there was a mineral, I think it might have been a mineral or a crystal that they wanted, and they couldn't negotiate something, so they just took it. And because they always know that the planet Earth, because they've left Earth, they're not really part of Earth anymore, are these dark factions. They don't really care if they give Earth a bad name, you know. So that was our job, you know, to fix that. But they went in and they killed a bunch of these folks. And so they were very fairly stoic people, but it was such an emotional time because of the terrible thing that had happened. And they understood that we weren't from that faction, but they also hold us as a race. This is kind of how it works. When you're advancing, you're not held by factions on Earth or any other planet as a race. You're held responsible as the whole race. So that's why we had to do so much fixing. So we were talking, and what happens in these meetings is I'm just basically a silent observer. I'm right there with one or two other people who are the decision makers, you know, and I kind of report to them, you know, tell them if, you know, something I'm getting from these races that they can't connect to, say, like telepathically, I can tell emotionally how things are going. And I can say things aren't working out. You need to change your tone, or you need to, you know, this is what you need to do to get through and work this thing out. So I was just there supplementally for the most part. And it wasn't going well. And I was trying to tell my superior, I was like, you know, you really need to understand that these people don't have emotion, but when they do, it's extreme. And we're really lucky we're not all dead right now, you know, because they're really mad, you know, about what happened. And you need to calm down, because my superior was a very forceful person and very stone-faced, basically. And they were feeling like he wasn't understanding what happened and the gravity of what happened, and they weren't getting anywhere with him. So they became angry. And the one main, there was three of them, the main one in the middle just kind of lifted up, say we're across the table about 6 feet away, and he just ran his hand across his chest. And in doing so, it shot out a beam of energy, which hit me right around here, my right shoulder area. And it was a devastating blow, just because it was like an energy weapon, really, that came from his chest. I don't know how that works, but that's what happened. And then, of course, everything went really bad, and nobody else was hurt. I was the only one, fortunately, because they regretted instantly that they had done that. And then so, fortunately, that was able, later on, they were able to come to an agreement because of that incident. But I was taken away immediately because I was not expected to live. So they took me away and they removed my consciousness because my body was dying. And I think I probably actually did die before they can get me and my consciousness taken out and put into a clone that they had, because they always kept clones as backup and reserve in case something goes wrong. And so they moved me into a new body and continued from there.
Well, I know others have talked about that when they're serving in the secret space program, clones are created and they're held, like you said, in reserve in case you get killed, and then the consciousness can transfer over to that clone. But of course, in your case, we're not talking about a cloned body. We're talking about your original body that had been age progressed. So now that's been lost.
Yes.
And now you're in a cloned body. So was there any kind of loss of memories? I mean, because I think that what they valued most was your connection to your prior lives, and that was the justification for the age progression. But I guess after serving for 21 years, a lot of those memories would have been now part of your consciousness. And so
All
of that was easily transferred over to the clone. Is that kind of how the way it worked?
Yes, that's exactly how it worked. The only side effect to being moved into a clone body was just almost flu-like symptoms for a day or two, just as your energy body kind of balances with your consciousness and it all kind of comes into sync. But other than that, everything was intact.
Okay. So you said this incident happened about a year after you signed up for the first time. So in 1970, you're two, your age progressed, you begin, you serve for 20 years, you don't sign anything for that 20 years.
No.
Then in 1990, you sign up for a renewed 20 years in the back. So you're not age progressed then.
No.
Then a year, so why did you decide to sign on again? Why did you decide to do a second 20 and back?
Because I was loving what I did. Absolutely loved the work I did. It was tragic and sad at times, but I felt like I was just helping the whole planet by being there.
I see. So you're now in 1991, when this incident happened, your body physically is 46.
Yeah, exactly.
46-ish.
You're
46-ish, right? You're killed. And your consciousness is transferred into a clone, but the clone is, again, of a 25-year-old.
Yeah, they kind of like create them that way and they stay stabilized in that. I think it's because that's the physical body at that age is kind of prime, you know.
And how do they do it? I mean, when they create a clone body, how do they preserve it? I mean, is the clone just kind of like kept in reserve, just kept in the stasis chamber, and just kind of like a 25-year-old clone of you is just kept there for, like, I guess that was there for what, 20 years or something? Or do they renew it?
I assumed it had to be, you know, had to be there, you know, at that time for that period of time. But basically they're just in tubes in another type of gel that just keeps everything, you know, alive and active, and bodies actually functioning, and you know certain things aren't, obviously, but that the cells within your body are living, and they're just kept at a rate that it just doesn't age. I'm not 100% sure how it works, but
So you remember this time, you know, this was the first time you actually remember signing something. So what was it you signed, and with who?
I had a superior that I worked with the entire time, the one particular man. And I'd always negotiate through him. And, you know, just another, the new contract, really there was nothing much to it other than I would continue providing my services as I had been. And, you know, it's going to be another 20 years. So there's really nothing significant to any change to what I was already doing. And so I just agreed to stay for 20 years, basically, is what it was.
Okay, so you continue doing what you had already been doing. So you serve another 20 years. So now we're talking about 20 years from 1990. We're talking 2010. And you sign up for a second time. So this is your third 20 and back. So
Right. Was
there anything different about that signing up? And what happened then? And again, you would be, I guess, you would be in a 45-year-old body.
Yeah. I kind of made a couple of agreements because I knew I probably wouldn't go beyond that. You know, I thought 60 years is a long time, you know. And what my negotiation was in that was I wanted to have a 25-year-old body again. It was pure vanity. So they agreed to that. Also, I wanted, you know, a financial settlement when I came back to Earth, you know, retirement. And I wanted to bring some of the technology I had been working with back to Earth, because I knew it would help humanity as far as physically heal, emotionally heal, you know, and open their minds and understanding to that there are greater things out there. So they agreed to all of that, you know, and we got into a little bit of a slight argument, like, well, you know, because I I'm a good guy, I'm a nice guy, but you know, I can be a little snarky. So at times. So I was like, you know, I'm gonna remember all of this, you know. They go, no, you're not. You know, I know I'm going to remember it. So I was always telling them I'm going to remember. And so at the end of that, when I signed my second contract, you know, he said, you are not, you know, they promised anything, you know, that I wanted, because they again assumed I wasn't going to remember. You know, so we kind of got into that. And so for the most part, I did forget for most of my life. And then it did come back later, you know, through series of meditations and working with past life trauma and regression and kind of dealing with those things, get those things out of the way so the memories can come back. So they gave me, when they wiped my memory at the end, they kind of gave me a double dose, because I kept saying I'm going to remember, and they said, no, you're not going to remember, you know.
Okay, so this third 20 and back that ran from 2010 to 2030. So that would mean that right now, as we're talking, you are still in that timeline of completing this third 20 and back, and you're still with this United Nations Secret Space Program, but you're also leading a conventional timeline where you went back and you've lived it all over again and slowly regained your memories.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-bending, but yeah. Yeah, there's a separate timeline where I'm still out there, still in the SSP.
And any kind of interaction with that, or any kind of memories about that final time? Because I know people are talking about their secret space program service, and some people have talked about that it's only after the 20 years service has been completed that you start to get the memories back. So now, you know, because you've served three terms of service, that you know, the standing, the theory might be, and I'm just proposing that and see what you say, that because your first two terms of service were completed by 2010, that you would be getting all of those memories back. But this one that you're currently serving now, because it's still happening, you're not going to get any memories of that. And I guess maybe that's a kind of fail-safe in the way it works. I don't know, just wanting to get your kind of response to that.
Well, you know, I have to admit, that's a thought I've not had. But it makes sense to why there are times that I find it really difficult, where my memory is, you know, memory can be tricky anyway. You know, and I'm always really careful about my memories. You know, if for me to say something out loud, especially publicly, I have to be certain that this is correct. And if there's any doubt, I don't really discuss it. And so I always say, is this a memory from SSP experience? Is this a memory from a past life experience? Or am I just connecting to the Hall of Akashic Records and I'm pulling a file from someone else that I'm seeing? Because we do that at times. And so people get memory kind of mixed up there. But that makes some sense to me, that would be why there are times that I'll have just a flash of a memory and then have to flesh that out by seeking and searching. Because there are certain things that I know I should remember, you know, but it just won't come through.
I see. So you said that one of the conditions for your signing up for that third time is that when you come back, you'd get some financial compensation, and also you would be given some technology to help humanity, that you would release that. So has that happened? I mean, have you been kind of helped in some way in either of those regards in your conventional life?
I have not, you know, because if you can't prove you had a contract, you know, I honestly remember the contract number I had, my ID number. I remember that. But I've chosen not to pursue that just because I don't need to. So no, I haven't gotten a retirement, but I have created and started selling and releasing a piece of technology that I did bring back that they used to remove extraction, extract your consciousness or memories. And so there's a device that they use for that, which I use for something different. I don't build it the way they built it. Theirs is electronic and is meant to remove memory and to affect the brain. Mine is not. Mine's more, it's all magnetic. And it actually helps the body heal, and it brings exponential amount of energy that we already draw in, you know, from the planet and from our surrounding area. And this just amplifies how much energy our body brings in, and it allows our body to heal itself. You know, so that's what I've been working on.
Well, this is, I assume, the DEEMS device. And
yes.
You've mentioned that you had an information dump that led to you developing that. So can you explain how you came up with this DEEMS device and what's it stand for?
Well, it's spelled DEEMS, D-E-E-M-S. And I have a podcast, and I had at the time when this information came through, it was called the Divine Evolution podcast. And so I just call it the Divine Evolution Electromagnetic Micro Singularity Device, because that's what it does. It creates piezoelectric energy and creates a microscopic singularity to source energy. And so the device itself, I have to apologize. My brain went totally blank just then on what other part of question you had for that. You could remind me.
I just wanted to know about the information download.
Oh,
how you
right? Got... Yeah, I was in meditation. This was a couple of years ago. I kind of get into a very deep meditation at times, and I didn't remember anything about that the device specifically. And then just instantaneously, I don't know that it was new information. I think the information was there. It was just unlocked in my brain. It was suddenly unlocked. I knew everything about the device. I knew how to build it, what to use as far as materials, you know, and what it did, how it works. Everything that could possibly be known about it was instantly in my mind. And so I started to develop that. But it came through a deep meditation process.
Well, the DEEMS device, I did check out your website where you discuss it a little bit, and you compared it to the Baghdad battery that has been found, and people have speculated for years over the Baghdad battery. So how is the Baghdad battery similar to the DEEMS device?
Well, they're quite similar. The Baghdad battery is a copper tube, you know, basically, and then there's an iron rod that goes within that copper tube, and that whole thing is placed inside of a clay jar. And that clay jar is filled with some sort of electrolyte type of material, whether it's vinegar or wine or even a water that has electrolytes. And then those electrolytes cause an interaction between the copper and the iron. And then that creates an energy. And that energy was used in the Baghdad battery for a couple of things. It could be used for a very dim light in very dark areas. But also, they would place that on their body. Say if they had shoulder pain, they would lie down and they'd place that, let it sit there. And as it was creating this energy, it was fulfilling or giving your body energy, extra energy to heal. You know, and that's kind of how rapid growth and rapid healing work, is allowing the body kind of to do it itself, just giving it the energy to do it. So yeah, they're built very similar. And the DEEMS device is the same thing. It's a copper tube, iron rod in the middle, and then it's a series of series of magnets, and those magnets provide here I can show you. So basically it's this, and there are 13 batteries, or I keep saying batteries, sorry about that, 13 magnets that come down and go around. There's an iron rod separating them, and it comes around, so it creates a magnetic field. And then it comes around this ring magnet, and this ring magnet is polarized in a way that it pushes, as the energy comes around, it pushes it this direction. And then in the, as it spins this way and is pushed out, it creates a vortex here, like a little tiny, you can imagine like a little tiny tornado. And so at the tip of that tornado or vortex, which is about here, there's a zero point of energy that's basically source energy or energy, thought energy, manifestation energy. And that's the kind of energy that our body uses, our nervous system uses as well. And another part of this is if we, the magnet wants to naturally sit like this, but I turn it and put it this way and force it to stay that way. And when you force a magnet to go against its magnetic field, two magnets to go against their field, you create a piezoelectric energy. And the piezoelectric energy is the energy that's within our pineal gland. And because our pineal gland creates piezoelectric energy by crushing calcite crystals. And then that's the consciousness, that's where consciousness is attached, is through the pineal gland. And piezoelectric energy runs through our nervous system as well, but you know, it was created in our brain. And so that's how in the SSP, they would take a device similar to this, though this could never harm anybody. It's not built that way. It could never take your memories. It can't detach your consciousness. It just isn't powerful enough, or it's not even built to do that. But theirs was. So they would take theirs and they just put it against your temple and they would put you out. And then they would, because they had a connected to a computer, and it would basically just draw your consciousness out and put you in stasis. So this one can't do that.
Now, I know you have different crystals that can be attached to that circular magnet at the top of the DEEMS device. And so those crystals kind of like amplify or concentrate the energies that are coming through to particular frequencies or wavelengths that align with the chakra. So I'm wondering, it seems like it could actually stimulate consciousness in a way. And you know, I'm wondering, in the ancient Sumerian cuneiform texts, there are pictures of Enki holding what looks like a pine cone pointing to the human skull. And I wonder if that's something like a DEEMS device that's harnessed for the pineal gland to stimulate it. So can you do that with your device?
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need a crystal at all to use it. You don't, you put it up against your third eye, you can most likely feel it. You know, most people can. And what it's interacting with that, with your pineal gland and that, your third eye chakra or your energy center, that because our body has a number of energy centers. That's why we have acupressure, acupuncture. That's why we have meridian system in our body. That's how we have centers of energy. And that's what chakras are. There's some of these, they're the larger centers of energy. And so each crystal stone has a certain color. And that vibration of the color of this and the crystalline structure of the stone is the same vibration of certain parts of your body. And so like a blue stone, or actually say green, because I have a green one sitting right here. This one doesn't have magnets. This is just a broken one that's just sitting here. But if I were to attach it like that, which I can't because I don't, this one doesn't have any magnets, but the energy would come through and become concentrated at the tip of that stone. And then now this energy is not just universal earth energy coming through, it's filtered through a stone that has the same vibration of your heart chakra. So you can target areas of your body by using certain stones. So you don't need to have them, but if you do like Reiki work or acupressure, acupuncture, these can be handy.
So the DEEMS device seems to be a kind of an evolution of the early Nikola Tesla electrotherapy technologies that he came up with at the beginning of the 20th century, at the end of the 19th century, that this technology has been withheld from us for over 100 years because of the secret government because of the dark cabal that wants to keep us dumbed down, but Tesla's technology was suppressed. So it sounds like it's coming out now through people like you and many others that are now talking about electrotherapy, and whether they're getting downloads or whether they're being helped, it looks like this is a time for these kinds of electrotherapy technologies to really start helping us move forward in healing and getting our planet on the right path.
Yeah, I believe so. Absolutely do. You know, because I know that crystals are used with every race because they understand what crystals actually are. And they know that they have the power and ability to work energy, you know, and everything is built of energy. We're photonic, you know, photons are energy, you know, and their vibration, and we're built, you know, out of light. So we connect highly to it.
So where do people go if they want to get more information about the Deems device and start communicating with you?
Just go to deemscompany.com. So that's deemscompany.com, deemscompany.com.
And you're going to be a speaker, as am I, at the October 21st to 23rd Spiritual Informers Conference. So what are you going to be talking about?
Pretty much what we talked about today for the most part, and I'll get more into the Deems. And I actually have a tent, you know, my company's there, and I'm bringing some people in with me, and we're going to, you know, allow people to use the Deems for free and do some healings on some people. And we have a Curlian photographer, which people also know as an aura photographer, and they'll take your photograph prior to, you know, even picking up the Deems. All you got to do is pick it up and your chakras line, you know, that's what it does. You know, it just gives your body energy to do it. And then we'll photograph you afterwards, and you'll see a comparison of how your energy body reacts, you know, to these magnetic devices. So we'll be there for that. And then I'll also be, you know, speaking on my experience. And there's, you know, other information that, it's best brought forward in person versus, you know, via online. And so that'll come out as well. And we'll just see how things go as far as that is concerned. But it should be an amazing experience.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting you at the conference and, of course, seeing many others that are talking about similar experiences and similar technologies. And that's October 21st to 23rd in Orlando, Florida. So I hope the audience can come and check out all the speakers and look at the Deems device. I'm certainly very, very interested in that. So I want to thank you, Chris, for coming on ExoPolitics today and sharing your amazing experiences and knowledge about the secret space programs.
Oh, it's my honor. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me here today.
Well, thank you, Chris. I'll put the details for Chris's website and also for the Spiritual Informers Conference in the description. So thank you and aloha.
Well, we'll see you guys there.
You have been listening to ExoPolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.